back out this morning that's 101 years old right now. It was first published in the 9th edition, which was the Joe Hill Memorial Edition of the Industrial Workers of the World Little Red Songbook. So it was March of 1916. Dump the Bosses Off Your Back by John Brill. Are you poor, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Oh, is your life full of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. So let's try that verse together. Are you poor, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back.
Now, we need to have the Digger song here today. I think the last time I sang it out here might have been 1649, the St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people of will. They defied the landlord, they defied the law. They were the best, destroying what was there. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make wasteland grow. If we're divided, we will make whole. So it will be a crown of slavery for all. The sin of poverty we do disdain. No one has any right to buy or sell the earth for private gain, but theft and murder, they took the land. Now everywhere the law cries up a fair command. We work, we eat together, we need no source. We will not bow to masters nor pay rent to the Lord. We are free people, we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. They make the laws to claim us well. Their clergy saddle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve. God of freedom, peace, the religion. We work, we eat together, we need no source. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the Lord. We are free people, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property, order came. They sent their hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' slaves, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still their vision lingers on. You poor take credit, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people of one. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now.
I want to jump to this special situation that's going on with this right wing attack on Berkeley. These two or three episodes where we've had the right wing coming in here and we've responded in not always the most positive way. Well, that's the problem. We have within us. Yeah, that's the problem. But the bigger problem is that we don't, I think the community doesn't quite understand how we have to deal with fascism or the Nazis. We can't let them mobilize to a point that they can exist and they can hurt us. Now, free speech gives them that opportunity. If we're for free speech for the Nazis, that's a mistake. That is a mistake. So, comes up and he says, I got a minute. And right now I'm at this situation where I'm trying to think about how to express ideas to not be for free speech for everyone, not free speech for the Nazis and the fascists. If we allow them to organize, there's another problem within our situation. We don't have unions that will call a national strike. Very important historically. Countries had unions that could call a national strike and call up with that. We don't have that. So we are at definitely disadvantaged. And we have to understand that we have to fight these motherfuckers. We can't let them exist. Thank you. They hung out on Telegraph Avenue in front of Cafe Mediterranean for years. It was called they called themselves the Red Rock. And it turned into a book that showed out Rag Theater. But anyway, those clips hung out there. And then what happened, this is my contention, the CIA brought in heroin. And it turned, we still have now a heroin epidemic from that intervention by the CIA and FBI with the kids. Now about half of those kids died. Half of those kids have died. My daughter knows they're gone. They were naive to know what they were into. They call it Persian dust and something white, I forget, but I wasn't into it. They were fooled by the cocaine. Right at the same time that the left started to use cocaine in the early 70s. So, let me look here. I'm not going to be too long. You guys about ready to go? Well, you're still waiting for your God.
$1 million they can spare, and I'm going, the only people in the world, the Saudis, can you spare I will give you $750 billion. All I want is a picture of Angelina Jolie and Louis Walsh. I changed that reference for England, thank God that worked. Thank you. But it was the economy, the whole thing, and the whole debate. Basically, it was we had Obama, Fresh Prince, McCain, Uncle Fester on the Adams Family. And the debates were so amazing. The first debate, two people speaking in complete sentences after 8 years of W, I was going, thank you, God! I was beginning to think our electoral process was like the Special Olympics of politics. I was like, no! The second debate, McCain started to get a little like, that one. And then the third debate, oh, wow, McCain was just like, he starts to look like your uncle who's on a new drug and he hasn't got the dosage right. And you find him wandering around the mall, going, I've got a plan! I know where Osama is, tell us! I'm not gonna tell you yet! Where's the plumber? Where's Joe? Where's the plumber? Get in the car, Uncle John, get in the car.
Even Donald, I think Donald Trump's hair is actually another creature.
Yeah.
The hair's like going, good night, Donald. Good night, Donald. There we go. Yeah.
Maybe it goes out. It goes out and makes money while he's asleep.
Yeah. Donald goes to sleep and the hair's going, keep investing. And then it comes up.
Think big.
French meth addicts. They'll be there. Going, I know where you live. But I don't leave my house. It's crazy,
I don't think there's a lot of French meth addicts. I think it's maybe just one guy.
The one guy just wandering around France going, I know where everyone is.
I'm not worried about that.
The crazy ass things out here. I mean, it's wonderful when you go to France. I was once in a French toy store and my daughter was playing with a little ball and the French woman said, put it down. It's a toy store. Don't touch it. We don't play. This is my good luck sock, Craig. Put that on there.
Well,
I don't know why.
In Scotland a few times.
Oh, fuck. great. I've been there. It's great. You need a translator as you get further north.
Yeah, no, it gets... But I do, too. When I go to Scotland, the I mean, because that translates as what foot do you kick with?
Right.
Is that some sort of Catholic? And then you have a fight. Yeah.
Right now, you know, everyone for Easter, it's going to be an interesting Easter for the Pope. Everyone else is hiding eggs. He's hiding priests. Brillante.
Yeah, brillante, yeah.
¿Quién es más macho? ¿Qué es más macho? ¿Qué es más macho? ¿Qué es más macho?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, all right. I have no idea what you said.
Neither do I, but God bless us all.
What happened?
I was on Letterman, and I said, Australians are kind of like English rednecks, and... obviously...
Wait. Robin Williams, hobos, you don't know who... Robin Williams. No chicken. There could be a war.
Oh yeah, there's very little difference between a Bubba and a Bruce. Good luck, yeah. Right.
I don't know.
I meant to say it was just like, you know, the idea of you take the English accent. Hello, good
hello,
to see.
Hello, yeah.
Good to see you right there, and you take the yeah, hey y'all, good to see you, and you combine it, you go, good day. Nice
good
to
day.
See you
right
there.
Right, yeah.
That's why it's more like, you know, you put the two together and it's more like, you know, it's like English good old boy. I should have said good old boy, but I said redneck and I realised don't use the R word.
No. Oh, is redneck's not a derogatory
term? Well, there was some Robin Williams talking about
I wouldn't say that
cocaine and segueing from the left, finding it fashionable to get the heroin slipped in after the Summer of Love became 68. Hi, Robin. Thank you for bashing Bush. Sorry I didn't line it up right. Let me go back to Endless Bad News and Horror.
There is an article on Syria entitled Who Chemicalized Deir ez-Zor, a town in southeastern Syria not far from the Iraqi border. The subtitle explains that the U.S.-led coalition is being suspected by the Syrian government of bombing an ISIS warehouse containing chemical weapons. Below the subtitle, there is a photograph of a U.S. military plane with a caption. The official Damascus claims that the bombing of the U.S.-led coalition led to the extensive number of casualties. The article reports that the spokesman for the Syrian Ministry of Defense, Samir Suleiman, stated that on April 12th, the aircraft of the U.S.-led coalition bombed an ISIS warehouse with chemical weapons near the town of Deir ez-Zor. He said that this attack led to both militant and civilian casualties. In addition, the town's people saw a thick white-yellow smoke coming out of the area under bombardment. According to Suleiman, this is the sign that ISIS, just like Jabhat al-Nusra, is in the possession of chemical weapons, which are being used against the Syrian army and also against the civilians. However, according to the article, the U.S.-led coalition denied that they made any bombing raids on April 12th. The Russian Ministry of Defense also could not confirm the reports of civilian casualties. Yet, a highly placed diplomatic source, wanting to remain anonymous, said to Izvestia that there was indeed a powerful explosion near Deir ez-Zor on April 12th, but he could not corroborate the reports of chemical poisons being released into the air. A specialist on chemical weapons contacted by Izvestia stated that yellow smoke could easily be an indication of poisonous chemical substances. According to the article, there were already several instances when the terrorist groups in Syria used chemical weapons against their opponents. However, this is not something that the U.S.-led coalition is willing to accept, and it has preferred to blame the Assad government each and every time. This article also sought a commentary from Senator Franz Klintsevich, one of the most influential lawmakers in Russia, currently the deputy head of the Committee on Defense and Security in the Federation Council, the upper house of the Russian parliament. Klintsevich, who frequently comments on military and intelligence matters, stated that after the attack on Deir ez-Zor, it is clear who in truth bears the responsibility for the civilian casualties in Idlib on April 4th. In his opinion, the chemical weapons incident was used by the United States to discredit the Syrian and Russian governments' successful efforts against the terrorists, and also to prepare the international public opinion for the eventual overthrow of Assad, his arrest and trial as a war criminal in The Hague. In my opinion, this is something that the Russian government will do its best to prevent at any cost. Assad is the only significant political actor in Syria on whom they can rely in their fight against the terrorists, who also represent a national security threat for Russia itself. The logic of the Russian government is that unless ISIS and other terrorist groups are destroyed in Syria, they will attack the Russian mainland and cause severe damage. This is exactly what we have seen in the last few weeks, including the suicide bombing in St. Petersburg metro. In addition, the ISIS terrorist danger was also the main topic in the recent public speech by the director of the Russian Law Enforcement and Counterintelligence Agency, FSB, Alexander Bortnikov. It is ironic, but also very revealing, that while Bortnikov focused on the real evil of our time, international terrorism, the director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, in his first public speech, hardly mentioned ISIS, but spent half of his time targeting Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in a rather ominous manner.
Because, cui bono, because everybody knows WikiLeaks has the emails where they're saying, okay, $20 million to Clinton Foundation from the people creating ISIS. And Michael Flynn got drummed out because in 2012 he was in the DIA when they put the paper trail there saying the West is supporting the Salafist principality. And only a fool would not see that, because after we invaded Iraq in the second time in 2003, there is the 2004-05 Negroponte brings the Salvador option from Central American death squads. So he sets up Shia death squads, anomalous, because the Shia run away. That's the whole point, that Gandhi liked the Shia. Anyway, of course, Sunni death squads are what the West has used in the guise of this side or that. In Iran, you set up Shia death squads because in 78, Margaret Thatcher, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Ronald Reagan are in Tehran, and the Shah has a premonition. It looks like an opposition rally. The ambassador cable is saying that the Shah is noting. And of course, they are the guys that gave the weapons. Colin Powell sent TOW missiles from the Pentagon to Iran during the time they're holding our hostages, and that was all part of that deal. Hold them until the people that got the hostages taken, that $60 million, Abby Hoffman and some article about the $60 million kickback when Nixon, to Nixon from the Shah when George Herbert Walker Bush was head of the Republicans. So that's what he used to seal the deal that kept the hostages in the October Surprise, and So that's some of what the Pompeo, the CIA, would be mad about, because there's... Oh, I got to get to Bradley Burke and Phil talking about George Herbert Walker Bush's biggest payday. That's right. His biggest payday after he... Poppy Bush's employee at the Mena, Arkansas Coke stand, the governor that sends the National Guard, the Democratic... Dixiecratic governor, when the Republican Duke Majan knew not to back up death squads with the California National Guard, the Clintons were running that cocaine in and the guns to assassinate Ben Linder and tens of thousands of socialists in Nicaragua for doubling the literacy, cutting infant mortality in half, getting a World Health Organization award. Kind of like Libya, you know, you're going to bring down the death squads in Nicaragua and Libya. It's going to be the same George Herbert Walker Bush, son of Hitler's banker, and all. But that's some of what the CIA might be a little ticked off about.
The whole world could see that the U.S. and Russian intelligence have very different priorities.
But he's not taking everything into account, because there's some things they have in common. Like the KGB and the CIA staging the turf war over the Caspian oil, because remember, the skanky Yankee spawn of the misbegotten, the slime buckets up the Thames, the pirates of the Thames and Potomac won the Cold War. The West is not a direction, is a psychotic state, saying they're not people, and so they paid for the scalps. George Windsor paying 40 pounds, people of California, 25 cents for children, reimbursed by the U.S. Anyway. So, Big Brother is talking about the Russian racism and all, when they were doing the same thing that we followed suit a couple years later. So, this is from This American Life. Now, remember the theme, bad Russians? Well, why not throw some truth into the big lie? So, today on our program, we try to understand a little bit more about who Putin is and how he operates. He's been in the news for months, and I'll be frank, there are still some basic things about him and about Russia I went into this show feeling like I really did not understand, including, I don't know if you've heard this one, did he come to power in 1999 by first killing off a few hundred innocent Russians? And do people think about that and talk about that in Russia today? That's going to be the first thing we take up from WBEZ Chicago. Is This American Life? I'm Ira Glass. Stay with us, comrades. Ira Glass, Act 1, going in with a bang. So, have you heard this story? I just heard this for the first time recently, long before this month's St. Petersburg's bombing. There was another bombing that people speculated about, and in that one, there actually was some evidence that raised real questions. It happened right when Vladimir Putin was coming to power. This was back in 99. Boris Yeltsin was president, running Russia. Putin was the prime minister, not well known, not well liked, polling at 2% as a possible presidential candidate. And then Putin had only been prime minister for a month. There was a series of bombings of apartment buildings in Moscow and elsewhere. 300 people died. Putin blamed it on Chechen rebels, invaded Chechnya, started the Second Chechen War, which he won. It was a popular war, catapulted him into the presidency. When he took office, he had 53% of the vote. And even back then, when he took office in 2000, there was a question. Did he bomb those buildings himself to create the pretext for war and his own rise to power? If he did, of course, it calls the legitimacy of his presidency into question in a big way, murdering his own constituents, exactly the kinds of Russians that he claims to be serving and protecting as president. This story that Chechens were behind the bombing was kind of fishy. For starters, it was 3 years after Chechnya and Russia had finished a war. The first Chechen war, Chechnya basically won. They signed a peace treaty. What motive did the Chechens have to start this bombing campaign against Russia when they pretty much had everything they wanted? Now, at that point, this is the Big Brother that's telling us Assad has murdered 500,000 of his own people and he just gassed them. Now, the same question, when the inside job happens, how could they possibly, in this case, how could the targets of the war on Chechnya possibly benefit by blowing up apartments in Moscow? It doesn't give them a damn thing militarily. It gives the Russians everything, and there's that century of racism, the wicked Chechen sharpens his kinzel, but fear not, your father is a battle-hardened warrior. Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. From Lermontov, a century of racism, you know, lining up 8 Native Americans to put a musket ball through them. But then Russian America was wiped out except for where Baranov, the commoner, married Native in Sitka, in New Archangel. So Russians like Cortez are not as racist as the Anglos, but Pontiac waged war. He left the French alone when he waged war on the English, because only the English paid for the scalps of children. But back to what could the Chechens possibly win? There's that racism, then there's the same racism that we have against Arabs here in the West. That is, you know, the Syrian Arab Republic is the target. How could they possibly benefit by giving up everything they had won and giving the West the pretext that it needs to continue criminally marching north, east, and south from Tel Aviv? Anyway. There was no reason to fight the Russians at this point. They'd won the war. People were convicted. They were not FSB agents. They were not Chechens either. There have been people outside the government who tried to look deeper into the bombings, but overall, this hadn't gone well. Most notably, Independent Commission of Human Rights Activists, Politicians, and Investigators. The head of that commission was killed, was murdered, shot to death in front of his house. Another member of the committee died under mysterious circumstances. Anna Politkovskaya, Politkovskaya. Anna Politkovskaya, and when RT was giving the Politkovskaya prize to the Afghan woman, she's named for a famous one, shame on me, Malalaya, yeah, Yousafzai. Of course, it wasn't mentioned what Anna Politkovskaya had been covering. So Anna Politkovskaya, investigative journalist, one of Russia's leading investigative journalists, was murdered in her apartment building. She had written casting doubts on the apartment building bombings. And, of course, Alexander Litvinenko, Litvinenko, came out publicly accusing the Putin regime of doing the apartment building bombings. He is poisoned with polonium in London in 2006 and dies. Radioactive poison, polonium-210, slipped into his tea. British investigation determined two FSB agents had killed Litvinenko and that Putin had likely signed off onto it. Although polonium was what killed Palestinian Yasser Arafat, yes. So, there's that clue. And that Putin had signed off. In his autobiography, which came out in 2000, Putin roundly denied any FSB involvement in the bombings. Before the bombings, even before Putin came to power, Boris Yeltsin and his administration were plagued with corruption investigations. He worried they could eventually point to him and his family, especially if some other party or someone unsympathetic to him became president. So he looked to appoint a prime minister who he could trust. He fired two other guys in just 3 months before landing on Putin. Then he and Putin together had the apartments blown up as the pretext to go to war and in the patriotic glow to install Putin and quash the corruption investigations. Oh, that's from This American Life. NPR. So the truth in the heart of the big lie, bad Russia, when they are standing in the way of our terrorists, you know, Trump and Putin are colluding in ending our Contra war, counter-revolutionary, Quran-beating death squads. But never mind. Back to...
For the Russians, the choice is stark. It's either Assad in charge of Syria or ISIS in charge of Syria. On the other hand, the US and NATO, heavily assisted by certain Persian Gulf states, such as Qatar and Saudi Arabia, seem to prefer the latter option.
This video is one of the most difficult things that I've had to do. And that's because, you know, I wish things were different. I wish things had turned out differently. I wish that we had a government that respected the Constitution. I wish that we had a government that wouldn't purposely take the lives of people who believe in the Constitution. I wish that our government wouldn't practice soft and hard repression and therefore would not necessitate personalities like that of Lynn Stewart. Lynn Stewart is someone that I didn't get to know very well personally. But here's the thing. Even my mom, who had asked me, "Who is that lady? She's always where you are." the photographs, we would take the photographs. And then, you know, and Lynn was always there. She was always in the picture. She was not just America's attorney. She was America's activist. She was our premier activist. And we've seen it too many times. What happened to Lynn, even though the community rallied around her, oh my goodness, how the community rallied around Lynn. But the problem is that the government was on a path to show that lawyers like Lynn, people of conscience like Lynn, were not to be tolerated. And we've seen this before. We've seen it with JFK, MLK, Malcolm, RFK, members of the American Indian Movement, members of the New Left that were targeted in COINTELPRO, members of the Black Panther Party targeted by COINTELPRO, Filiberto Ojeda Rios, Puerto Rican independentista targeted by the U.S. government. We've seen this before, so we know what it is. But I'm sorry to say that, you know, that Lynn was a movement under herself. And when what happened to Lynn happened, she created a movement. A movement was created around Lynn, showing, giving back the tremendous love that she had for others. That love came back to her. And so Lynn left us knowing that she was loved. But why don't we have Lynn? Why is she not with us? What kind of government would do this to its own people? And what is our responsibility to Lynn to make sure that, even though as I say this, I don't want anybody else to suffer the same fate, but I know that it will happen over and over and over again until there is a consequence that the people of the United States give to those members of the deep state, whatever you want to call it, that perpetrate these kinds of acts. And I can say that from JFK, there was no consequence. Malcolm X, there was no consequence. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., no consequence. Bobby Kennedy, no consequence. All of the COINTELPRO, no consequence. All of the injustices, the insults, the indignities that we have had to suffer, no consequence. Nita Loy, who represents New York City, when the pro-Israel lobby, it became public that they were targeting me for elimination from the Congress. It was Nita Loy who came to me, and she said to me, and I quote, "Cynthia, every vote has a consequence." And so what I would like to leave you with is that the best memory that we can give to Lynn is that for there to be a consequence. Lynn wanted to make sure that there was a consequence for abridging our rights. That's what Lynn was most active on, protecting our rights, protecting the Constitution, protecting the people from a capricious and whimsical government. And so it's something that we have to do, and I have to figure out a way to do it. I have to figure out a way to make my contribution so that there is a consequence for the wrongdoing of government. There is a consequence.
It's noon. That means it's Mouse Report. Tuesday afternoon, but if you'll jump in the little way back machine, 24 hours or so. Actually, it was a little after 9 a.m. in the morning.
Fine. What's going on? Oh, we just dropped the WMD on Afghanistan-Pakistan border, so...
Okay.
I lived out here for a couple decades, and then things got a little better, and now things are a little worse, so let's see how it goes. I think you're probably familiar with Greg Allen Getty. I'm the protester known as John Del One that knew Brian Wilson when he had his legs.
Oh.
I lived out here for a long time.
Yeah,
so hopefully this is a one-time thing, you know.
Then I turn off my camera and we talk about other things, but where in this country is there a military target where an adversary could use a nuclear weapon, killing everyone for a square mile without committing a war crime by murdering innocent civilians? I ask Commander the Richard Lion, Commander Richard the Lionhearted, Abe would call him, Owens, and standing on the tracks of the weapons station that had shipped mass destruction to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Korea, Vietnam, Central America, and later Iraq and Afghanistan, he said, no, there's nowhere in the world where they could be used. A half a dozen years before the International Court of Justice decision on the illegality of radioactive mass murder of any kind, this should have been the end of the story. We would be planning a going-away party for ourselves at the tracks, but that was before Clinton's betrayals, Trump's WMDs, and the return to power of the very people whose crime drove us there. Well, I was talking about the post-Jim Crow coup there, 2000, that is. So it should come as no surprise that it was business as usual on Hiroshima Day where the nukes came from, the first since our Pentagon supposedly fell asleep to let two drone-piloted plane crashes bring down three New York skyscrapers. The record should speak for itself. Oh, and then in my little 5300 Port Chicago Highway, a murder mystery, I go to my YouTube thing, but just so I can get a better... I noticed my volume from the thing this yesterday at the tracks. Let me go to video. Let me go to... All right, that was last week's show, so it was a week and a day ago, but nevertheless.
Okay,
Well, we just dropped the WMD on Afghanistan-Pakistan border, so... Okay. I lived out here for a couple decades, and then things got a little better, and now things are a little worse, so let's see how it goes. I think you're probably familiar with Greg Allen Getty. I'm the protester known as John Doe One that knew Brian Wilson when he had his legs.
Oh.
I lived out here for a long time. So hopefully this is a one-time thing, you know.
But it wasn't, it was the second time thing, because the first was the killing for Al-Qaeda in Syria. And I remember that WMD thing was Afghan-Pakistan, but my flyer said, what kind of prehistoric monsters are we to be killing for Al-Qaeda in Syria? The killer cretins. So that's why I said meet Monday 4/17/17 at 9 a.m., because for all I knew, I'd be in jail the next Monday. At the tracks, 5300 Port Chicago Highway. I wouldn't want to send people out there all by themselves unless they knew that you got to keep your camera running in the presence, and if they arrest you for that, well, that's the case, and you take that, and you will win, because, of course, that's in violation of everything they swore to uphold. But...
Tall the tree that was in our...
Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, so, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future.
This is the Lucifer's Banker Hawks and Bradley Birkenfeld talking about...
Here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peace Mr. Prosperity
Bill's
Podcast.
Mr. Bill's big payday. He got $1.5 million, the most he ever made since he was president. The
today,
day Clinton, Secretary of State, is sealing the deal with Switzerland for the death
Banker,
squads
the
that... We're just
how
talking
I
about
destroyed
the
Swiss bank
Arab
secrecy.
Sting.
It's a story of intrigue that will both illuminate what's really
and he's
going
not
gonna,
he's
on.
He's
going
to talk about the Americans being cheated because he doesn't want to talk about
from
the assassination
his book's
campaign.
Description on Amazon, we learned that as a private
like,
banker working for the largest bank in the world, UBS, Bradley was an expert in the shell game of offshore companies and secret accounts that dominate the world of the ultra-wealthy. He wined and dined those clients whose millions of dollars were hidden away from business partners, spouses, and tax authorities.
Tax. So you got in the drug dealers, you had in the terrorist financing, insider trading, bribery, extortion, and so on and so forth, as well as intelligence agencies using Switzerland as a piggy bank to do their illegal business. One story comes to mind for your audience, which would be Iran-Contra. Iran-Contra, Switzerland was at the center of laundering money to the Contras and Iranians to do this illegal business.
Now, he said terrorist financing kind of buried into a bunch of other stuff, and then he says Iran-Contra, and then he says arming Contras. Well, that's what's going on, the Contra war. The terrorist financing, and he stops talking about terrorist financing. He starts talking about you're not getting your cut in the terrorist financing, right? Like these people are paying for the death squads, just need to pay their taxes, and then everything will be cool. Well, that's what these... Let me get off the mic before I do something that interferes and is counterproductive.
So I worked in this industry in so much as in Switzerland it was a legal business. It was a bit of a gray area when they told us you should go to the United States and see existing and potential clients because we weren't licensed to sell products or investments in the United States because we were in an offshore jurisdiction. Now, this had been going on before I was born, but also I was a part of it. I was in the middle of this, and it started to get a little bit strenuous because what was happening is they were telling us to do things that really didn't make us feel comfortable. And what it was take encrypted laptops to the U.S., which I refused to do. And they were telling us to do other training methods to avoid detection in the U.S. and lie on immigration forms, which I refused to do. And really what it came down to was I knew enough about the way in which the business was done. And then one day a colleague brought to me a 3-page document from our intranet. Well, the UBS intranet is massive, and you need to know everything on there technically as an officer of the bank. And I had a $10 million signature power, so I had significant responsibility and commitment to the firm and to the clients. Well, what happened was this three-page document that was brought to my attention contradicted everything they were telling us to do, meaning going to the U.S. and seeing clients that said you can't go to the U.S., you can't do account opening forms, you can't sell products, you can't do any of these things. So in essence, what they were saying is one thing, and in the background, another thing. And that document, the three-page document, which is in my book, Lucifer's Banker, clearly states that, one, this was sort of a setup. So the bank was protected, but the clients weren't protected, the colleagues weren't protected, and the shareholders were not protected. So this was really a matter of greed for the bank, and they weren't able to divorce itself from this business. They just kept wanting to make the money from it. So that was really what it came down to. And I challenged management on it, and ultimately I resigned from the bank when they wouldn't answer me.
So this was a heads they win, tails you lose kind of a CYA document, I'm guessing?
Absolutely correct, spot on.
Okay. So when you resigned, you then, but you had a lot of information and a lot of knowledge about what was going on, and the substance of that was that there were a lot of people in the United States who were still using this Swiss banking system in order to evade taxes at this point. And if I have the story right, your information helped expose 19,000 American names. I don't know if those are individuals or collected entities or how that stacks up, that appeared to be hiding money from the IRS. Did you tell us how it is that you came, though, to the decision to say, wow, maybe I should go turn whistleblower in this case?
Well, I initially, as I said, I saw this three-page document, which I went to the head of the department, who actually blew me off and didn't want to ruffle any feathers. So we almost got in the fisticuffs over that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you're putting everybody at risk here. This is not right. So I immediately gave it to some of my colleagues, senior colleagues. And then I sent an email to the head of legal and the head of compliance, two different departments. And I voiced my concern and attached a three-page document. And then I printed this off and then sent it to both of them in interoffice mail. So I was documenting and putting the material out there so no one could deny it wasn't out there. So I did that for 1 month, no answer. I did it a second month, no answer. I did it a third month, there was no answer. And at that point, that's when I started taking documents out of the bank and storing them outside of Switzerland in France. So that I was protected if anyone accused me of saying, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. I had the documents to prove it. Now, then I resigned from the bank. I resigned in October of 2005. Now, I started the whistleblowing in March of 2005. Now, this was a year and a half before the whistleblowing law in America was passed by Congress. So people say, well, you just did it for the money. No, I didn't, because I started my whistleblowing long before the law was even passed. So that's an important fact for your audience to understand.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is I then took the three internal UBS whistleblowing policies that they wrote, and I attached my three-page document and the information I sent to UBS Legal and UBS Compliance, and I sent it to the board of directors of the bank and said, now it's your problem. I'm a whistleblower internally. I'm telling you, and you need to do something about it. Well, that caused a huge problem for the bank, because now they knew they were on a stick for this extensive illegal conduct. Then they called an investigation. That investigation was just a sandbag job, and they covered it up again. So the board of directors of the bank covered up the largest and longest-running tax fraud in the world. So at that point, I had no choice but to then go to the United States government, my own government, and tell them about this. But unfortunately, the U.S. government was a part of it.
Now, the thing that makes this so totally believable is that he's talking about an assassination campaign, a violation of Title 18, Section 1116, 1117, murder of internationally protected persons. It's the law that makes it possible to go into a voting booth, because we know we're not picking somebody to be murdered with impunity. If they're murdered, we get to track the killers to our graves and theirs. Okay, there's no statute of limitations. So they are assassinating socialists, okay? Those seven countries on Wesley Clark's post 9/11 hit list wouldn't be targeted if they had accepted the carpet of gold But no, they wanted schools and hospitals, so they got the carpet of bombs.
They were knee-deep in it. And I can tell you why this is so damning is because the Department of Justice doesn't like whistleblowers, number one, because it makes them look like the fools they are. The second thing is, if they were so good, why didn't they uncover it? Why would it take a single courageous whistleblower to come forward and expose the largest and longest-running tax fraud in the world? And they were oblivious to this? No, they were a part of it, as I said. So this really was the problem. And then I knew that the DOJ was so hostile towards me, and I had to go to the SEC, the IRS, and the U.S. Senate. And if you go onto my website, lucifersbanker.com, you'll see under the UBS scandal, there are countless documents of the Senate hearings and GAO reports and so on and so forth that prove what I was saying was correct. And the government really didn't want to get involved in this because, as I said, a lot of these people were involved, CEOs, billionaires, politicians, celebrities, sports stars. And this is what happened. It is ingrained in America. 19,000 rich Americans, where the minimum account size was $1 million, had this at UBS in Switzerland.
All right. So, Brad, what I'm hearing here, though, is, you know, whether the DOJ was they didn't want to either look like fools or inept or something like that. But you also mentioned earlier that intelligence agencies had been known through the Iran-Contra example. We can assume that's not a one-off, but that there was there's possibly government involvement here at some level. So I want to circle back around.
Yeah, so we got to run down what we know already. This is Bradley Birkenfeld. He was prosecuted by Obama, whose Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is, of course, the wife of Bill Clinton, who was governor of Arkansas during the Iran-Contra investigations. And that's where Hassenfuss took off. Remember that 15-year-old with a stinger knocked down the dust squads, murdering tens of thousands of people because they had doubled their literacy, cut their infant mortality in half, won a World Health Organization award, which painted a target on them for being socialist, just like Wesley Clark's 7 countries to be destroyed in 5 years. Syria, you know, that sump of Libya. Was your Arab sting, but
round to that. But before we get there, let's talk now about how this case really started to come out. What you're describing
was getting prosecuted under Eric Holder. Now, Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer worked for Covington and Burling, the law firm for the Swiss Death Squad murder bosses, because remember, Swiss secrecy laws is developed to cover for terrorist financing. He mentioned it once, and then he goes on. When he talks about the American taxpayer is not getting their cut in the death squad profits. Now, I cried when the birdie died, when they put a gun in my little hands. So my killing my own kind just makes me puke my guts up, and I'll get off the mic. So.
Was that... Because it's encoded in the Swiss Constitution, this banking secrecy, you're taking extraordinary risk here, both with the Swiss government authorities, and now you're making it sound like also at least the U.S. Department of Justice authorities as well. That really sounds rock in a hard place. Again, why do I have that right? And if so, why did you do this?
Well, you're absolutely correct. But the main thing was the DOJ, I asked them for immunity. They declined. I asked them for a subpoena, a simple subpoena, which takes a matter of minutes to issue, and they refused because they thought, you know, we're not going to work with this guy. They were being very hostile. So I said, okay, you're not going to do that. Now, I can't give you names unless you give me a subpoena because I would go to jail in Switzerland where it's a crime to expose your clients, which I did not do. Mm-hmm. The only client I exposed was a client that was making illegal oil sales with Saddam Hussein, who had $420 million in 6 numbered accounts, who lived in a $50 million condo in New York City. Now, his name was Abdulaziz Abbas, and he's in my book. And you can see the account numbers there, and you see the entire information on this gentleman. The DOJ did nothing about this person, nothing, because he was best friends with Ray Kelly, the commissioner of the police department, and he was friends with Rudy Giuliani in New York. So you can see that there was political ties to this person, and most likely he was involved with the CIA because he was doing illegal oil sales with Saddam Hussein. So this in of itself was so damning. But then I went to the U.S. Senate, and they were happy to give me a subpoena. So by getting the subpoena from the U.S. Senate, I was insulated from prosecution in Switzerland, but I wasn't insulated from prosecution by the DOJ, who was furious that I left them and then involved other agencies like the Senate, the SEC, and the IRS.
Now, let's talk about this, because there's just so much smoke here. I know there's fire down here somewhere. Your information ended up exposing those 19,000 American names we talked about. Let's unpack this. How many of those names were actually turned over to the IRS?
Well, this is the problem. What we had and what we learned later as a result of WikiLeaks, and it's on my website again, lucifersbanker.com, there is... ironically, Aftenposten is a Norwegian newspaper that exposed a one-page CIA cable. And that cable showed that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, had secret meetings with the Swiss to settle the UBS case for political reasons.
Hmm.
Now, that's very dangerous. Yes, exactly. So what we have here is a Secretary of State who claims to be so above board, but yet was having secret meetings and negotiating only 4,500 names out of 19,000, Chris. Now, Chris, that's a 75% failure rate. If you fail 75% of the time at your job, or any of your listeners fail 75% of the time, they'd be fired.
Well, so, it goes beyond the failure. Who picked those names and left the other ones off?
Well, then you get into the more deep questions. Exactly correct. How were they selected? Did Hillary pick them? Did UBS pick them? Who was selected and why? And why wouldn't you get all 19,000 names, Chris? You know, five people rob a bank, you only get one person? No, you get all five. And this was going on for decades. So the very fact that she made a deal and negotiated 25% of the names and how they were selected, as you rightly point out, is really troubling. And you've actually, in effect, you've cheated 300 million Americans.
Yeah, Brad, I want to get to, this is just, here's where the sausage is being made. I'm
going to describe the obvious reason that she's going to be cutting some people out of investigations, because it would go to her assassination campaign, her violation of Title 18, Section 1116, 1117, murder of internationally protected persons. For nothing in the world would we want our people targeted as described.
Front yard. But it took me until I was actually doing my dissertation to get what those words were. And basically, it was a unitive experience with that tree as my mother, and that everything in me was of value, was powerful, that it was sourced by nature, it was sourced by this source that was larger than anything I'd ever known.
So I may have missed when you said what those words were. So maybe I missed that. What were the words?
The words that I heard inside myself
were
later on was, I am you and you are me, and all is of equal value. Grief and joy, death and life, all of that is you in me and me in you.
Louisa, just think what you've done, because I'm going to have to move on to the next call. But I want what you just said, I'm going to ask you to repeat it before we let you go, is what you just said is a part of what this show is about. For when we tell our stories, as you said, you connected with Diane's story, with Patricia's story, and your instructor, your teacher, giving you those words without explanation, but saying with such a ferocious attitude, that leaving you with that, you hear the words again, because this is really one of the intentions of the space between us, which you're listening to right now, and the we have lines open if you want to call 510.
It's 49ers 5150 to hell if you want to be in the endless bad news and horror, and 5 and dime 4951666.
I am her daughter, she is my mother. Without words, she asks me, what do you know? What is your name? Without words, I say, delight in little smut is my name. All of his vows break forth in due time. Ecstasy is as real as grief, and both are of equal value. The only work a child is play, I am she.
the changes of life and death on a spring evening in the front yard.
Thank you so much.
I have this part that you wrote here is just this is just astonishing to me, and that this didn't really come out more fully in the last election cycle. But it's that prior to Hillary Clinton's deal with the Swiss, that secret deal, UBS had only seen fit to contribute $60,000 to the Clinton Foundation. You wrote an amount that wouldn't even cover the bank's annual parking tickets, but that afterwards the Clinton Foundation's cash registers rang up $600,000 in UBS gifts. And the bank also then decided to partner with the foundation on inner city development programs, issuing a $32 million loan at very reasonable rates. And oh, suddenly the UBS also thought Bill Clinton would make a very fine paid speaker about global affairs. So they paid him $1.52 million for a series of fireside chats with the bank's wealth management chief executive, Bob McCann. It was Bill Clinton's biggest payday since leaving the office of the presidency. Brad, I got to tell you, that doesn't smell real good over here from where I'm sitting.
Well, let me tell you something. Not only does it stink to high heaven, but it shows the ingrained corruption of the Clinton family and the foundation. They're inextricably linked. You can't divorce yourselves from both. They're the alter ego of one another. And they use it as a piggy bank to curry favor with foreign governments and get these funds. Now, ironically, we found out just recently, a few months ago, after the election, that, geez, the Swiss government gave $500,000 to the Clinton Foundation while they were negotiating the settlement with UBS.
Oh, come on.
It's on my website. You can go check the article. Go on to my website. You'll see that this is what was going on. So how is it possible that you would be involved in such a nefarious act and a conflict, and you violated your oath to the U.S. Constitution? That's an impeachable offense.
It's astonishing to me. And so, you know, the subtext of all of this, which is really is that, you know, it's kind of crime pays, but it actually, it's that we entered a period of what you're calling no fault corporate crime enforcement. I think it began a long time ago, but under Holder, it became a real art form. So in this case, where UBS was eventually fined $780 million, for helping those U.S. citizens evade the taxes, what sort of a penalty was that? Was that several hundred percent of their ill-gotten gains, or you know, tell me what kind of a slap was that?
Well, for your audience, it's very simple. The math: the Department of Justice took an 8-year window, if you will, from 2000 to 2007. Pardon me, that's an 8-year window. That 8-year window, we made about $200 million a year in profits. Those numbers came from me, were given to the Justice Department, and that was in the deferred prosecution. By the way, the bank wasn't prosecuted. They got a deferred prosecution and paid $780 million. But really, if you run the numbers, $200 million of the $780 went to the SEC. So they really fined them $580 million. And they were making $200 million a year for an 8-year period. So the quick math tells you that's $1.6 billion, Chris. Mm-hmm. Where'd the $1 billion go? Just to make the U.S. taxpayer whole. Forget about fines, penalties, and interest. Then UBS claimed they couldn't afford to pay because they had hard times. They accepted $5 billion from AIG, which was taxpayer money. So we were laundering money through AIG to pay UBS, and they claimed they couldn't pay the fine. The political forces at bay at the time fixed it. The Barack Obama presidency is tainted and corrupt. And furthermore, Eric Holder in private practice represented UBS at Covington and Burling. Hillary Clinton had secret meetings with Swiss and sent two Chinese Uyghur Guantanamo detainees to Switzerland to settle the case. Barack Obama, who was Senator Obama, was on the Senate committee investigating UBS, but never attended one meeting. Not one. They were investigating UBS, but at the same time, he accepted millions of dollars from UBS for his presidential campaign. That is an impeachable offense. He violated his oath to the Constitution. He betrayed the American people, and you don't see any media outlet talking about this. Not one.
Indeed, we don't. And so I want to turn to what is, I'm sure, the darkest portion of this story for you was you being prosecuted. And I'm not aware of anybody else in this entire story being prosecuted or even losing their job. Maybe I have that wrong. But what happened to you? What was the specifics of the case?
Well, they gave all of my bosses above me secret non-prosecution agreements. Each one of them got a secret non-prosecution agreement. And even when the head of the private bank, Raoul Weil, was indicted and then called a fugitive 3 months later, a few years later after 2009 when that happened, he went to Italy and he was arrested on an Interpol arrest warrant where he was a fugitive. Well, now the U.S. was in big trouble because they had to put on this sham case in Florida. Now, when he was arrested and extradited to Florida, this is the head of the private bank for UBS. I gave that name to them. That's how they indicted him. But it was just a show maneuver. So when the trial came up, they never called me to testify, not once. They called all of my bosses who got secret non-prosecution agreements, and he was acquitted in about 30 minutes because the whistleblower wasn't able to testify in that case.
Wasn't able to?
Now, no, they didn't call me. They didn't want me to. They didn't want me at the trial.
Yep.
And they screwed up the case. So once again, 300 million Americans plus got screwed by the corrupt Department of Justice. They not.
Now again, he could be talking about Berlin Gildo. So that's the guy in Britain that was acquitted when he said, "But I was working for MI6." Okay. The people that created Al-Qaeda, and Annie Machen tried to tell Glenn Greenwald's Guardian, "Oh, do you guys know that you're paying to create these medieval killer Cretan death squads against the Gaddafi?" The Guardian said, "So what?" So they have to spin it as, "Oh, surveillance, surveillance. What if they looked at your undies?" And then people will get outraged. And here, they're not getting their cut. They have to pay taxes, but the guy is funding the assassination of our political counterparts. And that is such a mind rape to go into the, it's the ballot or the bullet. And if you go into a ballot booth, then you're just bending over to spread them to anybody that's going to bullet your choice. And then walk, because you have cloak and dagger, we pay people to do that. So how could anybody that picks up a gun and doesn't point it at the head of the cloak and dagger, like Getty versus Casey explained. It was the impulse to respond in kind. It was a factor that precipitated the bringing of this lawsuit. So, Getty versus U.S., number one, it was denied certiorari by the Supreme Court. That included Ginsburg, who in Sanchez Espinosa versus Reagan said the court could not have the expertise, you know, it cannot even open its eyes at the death squad assassination campaign. So anyway, back to
explosive, or it would have a placard on the front. Oh, that doesn't have a placard on the front. Maybe it is explosive.
You guys don't know what you're doing here.
I am going to block the.
I want these people treated under the Geneva Convention for prisoners of war. The task force has warned us now.
I'm going to block the.
United States.
I am blocking this.
Kaboom. And I knocked my camera battery off. And the policeman could hear the engine rev when he watched it. So he knew the guy was lying when he said I jumped up there.
I told him I was coming. He said, take him away. It's not Greg.
Yeah.
He's violating the law. He knows the law there and you should arrest him.
So, oh, no, no, no. Listen, that was for writing and paint. This is
Chalk, and that was Hiroshima Day, Ozen 2, 8602, and I was all by myself. Now, my little flyer doesn't have the date. If you come across Killing for Al-Qaeda in Syria, meet Mondays, 9 a.m. at the Tracks, 5300 Portugal Highway, to block weapons, and then it says gregfromtracks@gmail.com. This is Greg from Tracks at YouTube, so you want to see how it's done, come and watch my little video. And you can go out by yourself, and you know there's a federal court order that prohibits torture if you're passive. It means you got to be chill to the face of torture,
now, you
murder,
watch me go
and
wipe
everything
it off.
Done on your person because you
no
don't fight back.
I have no conception
you
anybody would be
back
offended by Chalk on Hiroshima
Day. Take it.
Educating
to
the children
and
what
the
their
jury acquits
do
you. In fact, they take it to the court, well, and I'm show you their torture of you, and the jury acquits.
He doesn't know it was Chalk, please.
Wouldn't there be, could you educate more people being someone other so you can tell, see this?
Nothing could educate, nothing in the world could possibly educate people better than the weapon for Hiroshima came from this base. And this is the anniversary. The United States of America murdered the children of Hiroshima.
Right, that's when the United States won that war.
Murdered the children. No, they had agreed to the same conditions that were accepted after the bombing was obviously to show Russians that we didn't care about military necessity. We would kill their children by the millions. And that's how we won the Cold War.
Okay.
So you understand, I don't need any of that money. In fact, I don't need any of that life. I would rather be dead. If you're going to say you're going to pull your gun and shoot me in the head, if I don't immediately get up out of the way, I'll say this is a good day to die.
So are you going to harm yourself?
No. I would harm myself by cooperating with murder.
Can you hang on one second there?
Yeah.
Hey, sorry.
At a certain point, you got to say, I can't live with that, sir. You're supposed to step into harm's way. Not run like lily-livered cowards saying you're going to murder all those children in Hiroshima and Nagasaki because the American serviceman is too pissing cowardly to go stick their necks out.
All right. No, not you. Oh, where were we? Let's go to Ivanka. Our Park Avenue Electra did it.
Who exposed the largest and longest-running tax fraud in the world?
And the substance of the case against you was that they said, if I have this right, that you had failed to be forthcoming about your clients, specifically one of them. And I believe Kevin, it was Kevin Downing who was prosecuting this, said, quote, with regard to whistleblowers, those who seek to be treated as true whistleblowers need to know they must come in early and give complete and truthful disclosures. Mr. Birkenfeld did not come in and give complete and truthful disclosures. Therefore, he is not entitled to whistleblower status. How do you respond?
Well, he's a fraud, and that's a lie. He lied to the Senate, and he lied to, and his colleagues lied to the Senate, and he lied to a federal judge in Florida who is as corrupt as the Department of Justice. The fact of the matter is, they knew I could not give names until I had a subpoena. UBS said the same thing. We cannot give names. I said the same thing. The moment I went to the Senate, I gave testimony to the Senate after the subpoena and gave all the names. And Igor Letikoff was in there. And the Senate shared the information with the DOJ, and they used that information to indict me. So they're lying. It's a flat-out lie. And it's even worse. To this day, Chris, to this very day, the testimony I gave almost a decade ago to the Senate, under oath, they won't give me my own testimony.
Really?
Won't give it to me. Because you know why? Because the information I gave about Alenikov is in there. I gave Igor Alenikov to them, and they had that information. And they even sent me an email saying, oh, we forgot about Kevin Costner. We forgot about Igor Alenikov, but we remember Kevin Costner. Oh, well, that's nice. How did that work out? So you see that they were all in bed together to bury this because they all look like idiots. And I exposed the whole scandal which they were a part of, because now they were scrambling for a scapegoat, and that was me.
Right, and just so people get the complete picture, the prosecutor at the time out of the DOJ was Kevin Downing, who is now, hold on to your seats, people, an attorney for Miller and Chevalier, a Washington, D.C. white shoe firm specializing in tax law, white-collar crime, and advising global businesses on government enforcement and compliance. What a revolving door. I mean, it just, between Eric Holder and on, I mean, this is a really hard impression for me to shake and for my listeners, which is that there is just this revolving door. They all protect each other. They commit massive crimes, and the laws don't seem to apply to them. In some respects, to get, you know, this isn't a political statement, but an observation, this was the odor that Hillary was carrying with her, saying, trust me, I'm electable, I'll take care of you. But we all know that the Clinton Foundation, what we saw of it, it was just a pay-for-play scheme.
Let us not forget that Trump's, he's talking about Trump's wedding guest, our sick fart joke of a president that's doing her bidding, doing the bidding of his wedding guest. So
that there's just massive institutionalized fraud and corruption ongoing. Is this a fair characterization? When did it start, and where do we, what's our hope in this story?
Well, the good thing is that I'm out and I published my book, Lucifer's Banker. I put a website together, lucifersbanker.com. I'm publishing my book in multiple foreign languages and lecturing around the world to educate the people, to show how corrupt the Department of Justice is, to show that there's this revolving door where Kevin Downing leaves the Department of Justice, goes to Miller and Chevalier, and is defending the people he should have prosecuted. This is outrageous. Why isn't there a Senate hearing on this? Why aren't I called in to testify in public and expose all of it? Because then you're going to have a lot of rich contributors and CEOs and politicians themselves say, we can't have him speak in public under oath because it'll expose us for what we are, frauds.
Well, absolutely. So let me just build, you know, it took me about...
Afghanistan, did you just drop the biggest bomb on? Yeah. What about your drone program? 90% of the people killed by your drones are innocent civilians. Yeah. We care about these specific people that get killed by gas. Yeah, what about the people you kill with your jets? That's an accident. That's a whoopsie. We didn't do it on purpose, like him. Well, you know, if you use a drone, 90% of the people that you kill are going to be civilians. Yeah, we do know that, but we don't do it on purpose. Well, that has to be on purpose. That's like drunk driving. I don't mean to kill anybody, but I get drunk and I go driving and I know I will kill someone. You drop a drone, you know you're going to kill innocent people.
Fort Chicago Highway, standing in the way, saying, over my dead body.
I feel like an angel. Sometimes I feel like the devil. Sometimes I am free. Sometimes I am bound. And I have been recruited. I've been persecuted. And it just seems to keep coming round. Yeah.